Good morning. Please seat. Please be seated. Well, good morning again, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, May 10th, 2023, and we have three cases scheduled on our calendar today, two of which will be presented by oral argument. I'm Sarah Wheelock, the presiding judge on a panel with Chief Judge Susan Siegel and Judge Jill Helbrooks. This morning we are holding our first argument in Courtroom 200 of the Minnesota Judicial Center. And then we will be recessing and the next argument will be on Zoom.gov. The oral arguments are recorded by the court and the audio recordings are generally available within 24 hours on the court's website. With that, Marshall, please call the first case.
The first case this morning is A221455, Liberty Construction
v. So, counsel, as you probably know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We have the podium in the center that does go up and down to adjust to your height, so please feel free to get comfortable before you start. And there's a timer on the center of the podium as well that will reset according to the amount of time that you each have for your argument. Please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument so that our recording is clear, and let us know how you prefer to be referred to this morning. Counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the court, my name is Steve Buterin, and I'm here on behalf of Liberty Construction to respectfully request that this court reverse the decision of the district court. And I do want to advise the court, I have a bit of an ear infection in my left ear, so I'm having a little difficulty hearing this morning. So I just wanted to let the court know that.
Thank you.
But I'm fine otherwise. So here the district court erred when it ruled that Liberty breached the doctrine of implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose. Contrary to the district court's decision, a breach of warranty or implied warranty is not and cannot be based on consideration of the quality of unfinished work when determining whether there's a breach of that implied warranty. The district court also erred in allowing Mr. Smith to recover damages for breach of implied warranty where Mr. Smith admitted that he denied Liberty Construction the ability to complete the project or the opportunity to cure any alleged defects with the work that had been done.
Did you raise the right to cure before the district court? Because I didn't see that any place in the jury instructions or in the special verdict form or in your post-trial motion.
I believe it was in the post-trial motion.
Because I read your post-trial motion, and I didn't see it in there. And you didn't file a motion for a new trial, did you?
The district court ordered the parties to file submissions and then issued it, and I don't believe there was a new trial motion made.
Okay.
But I think the issues here are twofold. One is the accrual date of breach of implied warranty claim. And the question is, when do claims based on breach of a construction contract's implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose accrue? And then the second issue concerns owner interference and the contractor's right to cure. And the question there is an owner precluded from asserting a construction contract's implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose where the owner does not provide the contractor with notice of the alleged defects or the opportunity to inspect or cure the alleged defects? With regard to the first issue, existing Minnesota law and the law from other jurisdictions limit the doctrine to projects that are complete or substantially complete. And in terms of the second issue, Minnesota law recognizes that a contractor's right to cure, and the implied right requires an owner to provide the contractor the opportunity to complete the project or to cure the alleged defects. And this is important because if those rights are upheld, it may obviate the need.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Buterin, but how long does a homeowner have to wait for the project to be completed? And this went on for quite, and I know there's mention of COVID-19 in here, but this all happened in 2018 and 2019, right?
Right. I believe the work started in August of 2019 and then went through to April of the next year. I may be off on that year, but.
Yeah, I think you're a year off there.
But it went from August, and it escapes me what year it was. It might have been, I don't know if
it was. Well, the contract was entered, you began it, I think, in August of 2018. But how long does a homeowner have to wait then? There were three inspections that were failed. There were months that passed.
I think
there was like a year. Wasn't it almost a year and a half since the start of work that Mr. Smith said, no, you can't come on our property anymore?
I believe the owner has to give a reasonable time period, and I'm not sure that the case law specifies the length of time that a homeowner must wait. I think it speaks in terms of reasonable opportunity to inspect and cure, and my understanding is that there were a number of conversations and discussions between Mr. LaLiberty, the owner of Liberty Construction, and Mr. Smith.
So what is your client's position on how long? I mean, the contract said 90 days, right? It would be completed in 90 days. But how long does a homeowner have to wait? What's your client's position on that?
I think it has to be a reasonable time, and I think that's going to depend. Determined on a case-by-case basis. I don't know that there's any set period. I think there are various permutations. You could have conversations that start early on in a project and continue through it. You may have situations where the project is completed and then issues arise, and then there's a series of discussions. And also, depending on the time of year, this is roof work, and I know that the weather is very critical to the industry, because a lot of time roofing work cannot be performed generally from about November, late October, November until April, because the cold and the icy conditions up on the roofs. A lot of roofing companies won't operate in that time frame because it's too dangerous for their crews. So, taking all that into consideration, I don't know that it could well be that the time frame exceeds or approaches a year or exceeds a year in time. But I think the critical issue, and the court would not need to address the right to cure or the owner interference claim, because the case can be decided on the breach of implied warranty issue. And to my knowledge, there is no Minnesota case nor a case from any other jurisdiction that has found liability for breach of an implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose where the structure being that issue is not reached substantial completion or final completion.
As you recognize, Mr. Buterin, were you about to speak? Sorry. As you recognized in your brief, but you rely on Robertson.
Yes.
But there's no statement in Robertson that supports your argument. You're basing it on a case where, of course, the structure was completed, as in the Washington case and some of these other jurisdictions. But there isn't anything in Robertson specifically or these other cases that address this issue, right?
That is correct. Robertson did not directly address this issue, and none of the other cases that we cited from other jurisdictions cited it either. But if one looks to the facts of Robertson and those other cases, the cases all contemplated or dealt with completed structures.
Well, it happened to be the facts in those particular cases, but
right.
I mean, you're asking, as you recognize, you know, you're seeking a precedential opinion here from this court, which really wouldn't have authority backing it.
Well, the authority, I would argue, is in Robertson by virtue of its facts. And I think the analogy I draw, and I didn't raise this in my brief, so the court can do it, you know, I don't know if it's appropriate, but I know in defamation cases there have been situations where courts have refused to apply qualified privilege because the Supreme Court has never, you know, applied it in certain types of situations. And I think that's analogous to this case. There is literally, as far as I know, no controlling authority anywhere. But the court, you know, has to, as best it can, find the law and apply the law as best it can under the circumstances. And I would argue that Robertson and the Howe case and the cases that we cited, by virtue of the fact that none of those cases involved uncompleted construction, and they all involved completed construction or contemplated a structure that would be built and completed in the future, that provides guidance and authority for this court to say the Minnesota Supreme Court has never applied it in this type of situation. It's not for us to extend it to these type of situations. That's for the Supreme Court to decide.
So as a matter of policy, though, what would be the reason for saying that the project has to be completed before suit? Because it seems like here, I mean, there was the roofing issue, there were the cardboard shims, there were the drywall screws, and that all needed to be redone. And there were two different city inspections where various things were pointed out. So what's the policy issue then behind saying, wait a minute, you have to let them complete, you know, and finish putting drywall screws in or whatever the work was that the contractor's employees were doing? And only then can you sue when the damages are going to be greater. I mean, that I just because I get the notion that the statute of limitations that recipient of construction services shouldn't have to sue before they, you know, they're at least allowed 2 years after completion, but why they can't pursue something for something that's already been done, I don't know why it couldn't accrue earlier under common law implied warranty.
I think the policy
argument. The policy reason, I guess. Go ahead. I'm sorry, I'm talking way too long. I apologize. Go ahead.
I think the policy reason is, how does one evaluate the quality of the work when the project's not complete? Construction projects, especially larger ones, but even smaller ones, residential, they're a series of components that are put together to deliver a final product that is the amalgamation of all the different components. So when does one determine, evaluate the quality of the work? At what stage? Is it the first day of construction, the third day, or the last day of construction? How does one, you know, if a wall is being built and it's only been half built, is that defective work? I mean, the question is, how does...
But when you're talking about what kind of screws were used, screws that, I presume the problem with drywall screws is that they were going to rust out. They weren't meant for outdoor. I mean, at least that's my understanding of the record here. And you've got cardboard when it should be something else. I mean, that's done already. So does the whole contract have to be done, or can we say, wait a minute, this part of it is done, and it's not workmanlike?
Because I think the policy is, up until substantial completion, the contractor always has the ability to go back and redo its work, and that's what often happens. You have the job supervisor or the foreman come through, inspect the work of its crew and say, hey, no, we can't use these kind of screws. We can't use this kind of brick. We can't use this kind of roofing shingle. And they have the opportunity to remedy the situation up until the point of substantial delivery or completion.
So that's a right to cure, though, right? I'm trying to figure out if being able to complete the project, let's assume that there were no inspections and you just kept going as is, so it was complete, versus a right to cure. Are those two different things?
They are in this context. The right to cure generally arises after there is substantial completion or final completion, and then the homeowner or the owner discovers defects. But during construction is a very fluid process, and changes are often made on the fly as the crews are working. And it's not a right to cure. It's a right to complete the work as specified. And during projects, it's not uncommon for, issues to arise where, maybe something was or installed incorrectly, and then the supervisor or the foreman comes back and says, hey, this is not acceptable. It's not the right of cure. It's still part of the construction process. The right to cure comes after substantial completion, because at that point, or final completion, the contractor says, this is the structure, it's fully complete, and then you can assess whether it was built in a good and workmanlike manner. And until the project is complete and all the individual components of the project are integrated, one can't say that the project is complete and that the contractor should be liable. I see that I'm out of time.
Pose one question, and yes, Perhaps you can address it on rebuttal, Mr. Buterin. But when you read the district court's order following post-trial motions here, and then you read its final order with the factual findings and legal conclusions, it's very detailed. And what Judge Wall said was that Mr. Smith could not recover on the breach of contract claim because there had not been substantial completion. And he also said it would be duplicative recovery if he had recovery under the implied fitness claim. But he never addresses this argument that there has to be substantial completion for the assertion of the implied fitness claim. And this sort of circles back to Judge Siegel's original question, but I don't see where that became an issue that was placed before the district court. So if I don't want to take this time right now, since you have time for rebuttal, but if you could respond to that, then I would appreciate it.
Yes, I will, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. And we will turn to counsel for respondent next. There are 15 minutes on the clock, and feel free to adjust the podium and begin when you are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Rebecca Schiller, appearing on behalf of respondent Dustin Smith. I came into this case a little bit late, as the court probably knows. I was not involved at the trial court level, but I have reviewed most of the transcripts relevant to the issues before the court today. And I'd like to start out by saying, taking this in a slightly different direction of looking at it based on the comments that the court has already made, with Mr. Buterin's presentation. The appellant is saying that that Judge Wall, the trial court, committed reversible error because he didn't apply that standard that, the completed work was completed and the homeowner obstructed or hindered the completion of it. And then in the reply memo, or brief, I should say, I kind of got a different idea of how to look at this and how it really comes down to what was in the jury instructions and what was presented to the jury. And it's about how reconciling that verdict with what the jury was provided. So I really think this case is more about the appellant trying to create a new defense that doesn't exist to the implied warranty claim. That defense does not exist in the law. Robertson doesn't stand for that proposition, as Judge Halbert's already pointed out, and as I pointed out at length in my brief. So really, he's asking the court to extend the law. Judge Wall did not extend the law. So I think it's to look at what the jury had in front of them, we need to look at the jury instructions, which were agreed to by the parties. There was nothing in the record that I saw that there was any objection to the written jury instructions. I attached those to my addendum for the court. And so I'd like to go through those and just talk about how the breach of contract, the jury verdict, and how Judge Wall decided it was based on those jury instructions that were provided by the parties. So the breach of contract, which, you know, the appellant was found to have damages related to the breach of contract, because the breach of contract has that defense in the jury instructions, specifically 20.56. It's the hindrance of performance of the contract. So they did award damages to the appellant on the breach of contract because that defense was presented and agreed to by the parties that that was a defense that the appellant would have. Now, with respect to the implied warranty claim, there's nothing in the jury instructions about hindrance of performance. There's nothing in there at all about it. If you look at the jury instructions, it's 22.35, 22.6, 22.65, and 22.70. And they set forth the definition of implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, the definition of the breach, and the calculation of damages. Judge Wall verbatim on page, it's at page 203 to 207 of the September 7th, 2021 transcript, he verbatim read the jury instructions that had been compiled by both parties to the jury. And the jury was provided with those instructions. And nothing in those instructions talks about incorporating language like substantial completion, substantial performance, or hindrance of performance. There's nothing about that defense in the jury instructions because that defense doesn't exist in Minnesota law. And again, the appellant...
Well, there's no decision saying whether it does or does not.
That's correct.
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 Yeah, so it's an open question.
It's an open question.
As Mr. Butrin said.
Okay. And again, the parties agreed to those jury instructions. And I think it's important, I had pointed out, you know, when the jury came back with the questions and Judge Wall asked them to, you know, read the jury instructions carefully. And in his order, there's a paragraph I'd like to read. It's paragraph 7 of the trial court's order, which is in the appellant's addendum, pages 2 through 14, I believe. And he makes the following observation. This goes to the issue of how you bifurcate the damages for the breach of contract and the damages for the implied warranty between the two parties. He said it is reasonable for the jury to have calculated breach of contract damages in consideration of Liberty's completion of the work and Mr. Smith's hindrance thereof, and calculating breach of warranty damages in consideration of the defective quality of Liberty's completed work, meaning the quality of the work that they had performed, not that the job had been completed. The court observes no other ambiguity or inconsistency that would require the court to consult the jury note to assess jury intent. Those instructions were clear. There was nothing about hindrance of performance. It had to do with whether the work was performed properly, and that was what the jury instruction with respect to the implied warranty said. And that's what the jury did. They awarded damages to the appellant for the breach of contract and found that both parties had breached the contract, and then awarded damages to my client based on the implied warranty, which did not require, there's no language in there about hindrance of performance or anything of that fact.
Doesn't an implied warranty come out of the contract? I mean, are you putting too fine a point on this?
I don't think so. I think the implied warranty is created by law, not versus the contract. They're two separate issues.
Okay, which law are we dealing with now?
So the implied warranty for a fitness for a particular purpose.
But which law? Is it statutory? Is it common law?
No, it's not
law?
Statutory. It's case law.
Common law. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
So
go ahead.
The defense that is referenced in the jury instruction 22.60 for the implied warranty is it's breached if the goods, services, or both are not fit for the particular purpose specified by the customer at the time of the sale. That's what the damages are based on. There's nothing to do, again, there's no language in there about obstructing work or anything of that nature. And with respect to jury instructions, the standard is that, I know Chief Judge Siegel had mentioned this earlier, there was no motion for a new trial requested in this case. And for there to be appellate review of the jury instructions, which that's not what the appellant was asking for, but it goes to the point of what the law is and what the jury had. He's asking the court to overturn the jury's verdict and to reverse Judge Wall. And with the jury instructions, there can only be reviewed if there was a motion for a new trial in which the matter, and that's the Estate versus Hartz v. Nelson, and it's 437 Northwest 2nd, 749. It's a Court of Appeals decision from 1989. A party's failure to object to the jury instructions or the special verdict form prior to is a waiver of that objection. And that's in Thebar versus Jungle, 291 Min 129, 189 Northwest 2nd, 493, 498. I would also say that the standard is if the court did want to review the jury instructions to determine, and the jury instructions, again, were verbatim read by Judge Wall to the jury, agreed upon by the parties. The standard for that is that the jury instructions contained error of fundamental law or controlling principle. That's the standard for review of jury instructions. And again, my position is that that's not before the court. The jury instructions can't be reviewed because they were waived. They were agreed to by the appellant. But if the court were to look at that, that is a standard, an error of fundamental law or controlling principle. And that's in, I don't know how to pronounce this name, but A-L-E-V-I-O-S, Alivos versus Metro Airports Commission, 425 Northwest 2nd, 492. And I don't see how anyone could find that the trial court committed fundamental, error of fundamental law when the parties gave the law to the jury. They agreed what the law was and what the standard should be with the facts and applied to the law. So how can that be a fundamental error by the court when that information was given by the parties?
So if I could interrupt you for a minute. So the jury did find that Mr. Smith made it impossible for them to, it's the last finding, Mr. Smith hindered, obstructed, or prevented from substantially performing, in that it, or make it impossible to perform without justification. There is a right to cure. So why can't we say, wait a minute, Mr. Smith made it impossible for them to replace the drywall screws without door, whatever the proper material is, showing my ignorance here, and replacing the cardboard shims for something that's up to code. So why shouldn't we rule that way?
Well, because that was already, the damages were already provided by the jury under the breach of contract for that hindrance of performance. That's where that defense comes in. So they awarded the plaintiff, I think it was $12,000 some dollars, and so they were awarded damages. The plaintiff was awarded damages with respect to that issue, that he hindered the performance. The breach of contract allows for the hindrance of performance defense. The jury said, yes, my client did hinder the performance.
So what does the $28,000 represent? Is that the difference in value for the partial performance then?
The jury instruction on that with respect
now
to...
What was argued to the... What evidence was given to the jury for them to come to $28,000? I can read the jury instructions.
Right.
I've read the jury instructions.
Right. Again, I wasn't there at the trial, but I did read... I believe my understanding was that the inspector testified about the defects in the various work that was performed, and that, the job dragged out for quite a long period of time. I believe that that's what it's based on. And the work that was performed, again, Judge Wall mentioned in his order, they could provide, he thought the jury was consistent wanting to award damages for the work that had been performed by the appellant. That was defective. So that's my understanding, is that the jury, again, the breach of contract, they gave damages to the appellant, but for the implied warranty, they gave, and the implied warranty has nothing to do with hindering performance. So it has to do with the work that was actually performed by the defendant. Or by the appellant, excuse me. So that's my understanding of how the jury awarded those amounts. That makes sense? Maybe.
That makes sense. Judge Hallbergs, did you ever?
No.
Okay. Is this opportunity to come in and fix it?
Okay.
And maybe that could have been for. It would have cost them less than $28,000, and they didn't have that opportunity. I mean, I guess that's what I'm asking about.
And the implied right to cure that was discussed in Mr. Buterin's presentation, and I addressed it in my brief. So there was two cases cited by the plaintiff with regard to the notice of defects, and that was it was MnStat 327A.02 subdivision 3. And that is, again, both the cases that he cited, the DeRozier case and the Zobel case, had to do with that right being within a contract. So this, the quote from DeRozier was, Minnesota statutes concerning residential construction require vendees to provide notice and opportunity to repair defects within a reasonable time following the home sale or home improvement contracts. Again, that was relating to the breach of contract. It's not in the record, but he disputes. He did provide them notice and a right to cure, but that's not before the court, so we're not going to get into that. But in the Zobel case, it also said, it's an implied condition that they can't unjustifiably hinder performance. But again, it has to do with the contract itself. Every contract contains an implied condition that each party will not unjustifiably hinder the other from performing. That's in the Zobel case. That's cited in both the appellant's brief and initial brief and my brief. So it has to do with the contract damages, again, that right to cure. And they, again, the jury decided, yeah, they decided that he did hinder performance, and maybe within that context, the notice of right to cure it is implied within that, or I guess within that time period, you have the right to cure is the same thing as letting, you know, you're hindering performance, same issue, sort of. So that's where, it goes back to the contract, and they did get damages for the contract. I went through all the cases at length in my brief. Again, there just simply isn't a case that stands for the proposition or the defense that the appellant is asking the court to create. It just, right now, the law, that's not what Robertson says. It does not hold that. It specifically, they admitted that it doesn't make that specific holding. So there was one thing I just wanted to address quickly, and I'm almost out of time, is that there was an issue brought up in the reply brief about the Terrell versus Palmer case, and that that was a patent case that did not refuse to extend the implied warranty to subsequent purchasers, basically a privity contract issue between subsequent owners of a house. But that case is completely different than this case. It was brought up by the appellant to say, you know, you can't create new law, and the court's not here. The trial court and the Court of Appeals doesn't create new law. That's for the legislature. Understand that position. But that case was about a statute that was created where it only allowed the subsequent purchasers and the original homeowners to sue with related to houses built 1978 or afterwards. And this house was built in 1972. So that was the basis of this. And we're not going to extend something that's pretty clear in the statute. We don't know what the legislature's intent was. That's a completely different issue than what we're dealing with here. So again, I do believe that, again, you know, it's a very high bar to overturn and dismantle a jury verdict and to basically reverse the court when the appellant really hasn't provided anything to justify that.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
So I asked this appellant, did Liberty forfeit the issue if we do find the right to cure is relevant?
I think so. I mean, I argued in my reply memorandum that they did not bring that up in the court below, and I believe the court raised that issue as well. I did not see it in the motion, and maybe it was in there in post-trial motions. I didn't see that issue. So, yes, I would agree that that's forfeited. And with that, I will end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we will have 5 minutes on the clock. And counsel for appellant, you may begin your rebuttal when you're ready.
Your Honors, the issue of implied warranty, I believe, was raised by the district court in its decision when it dealt with the issue of breach of contract, breach of express warranty. The jury found there was a breach of express warranty, but the court said that there could be no breach of express warranty because the project hadn't reached substantial completion. And then it goes on to address the breach of implied warranty to say that, you know, it does apply in this case, even though the project wasn't substantially complete. So I think the issue was...
Actually add that additional language?
Well, I was just paraphrasing. He went from express warranty, then he moved on
to the other claim, but he doesn't address completion when he addresses implied.
Right, and yes, that is correct, and I guess I was taking too much liberty. I was referring to it, the implication is that he was addressing the issue of substantial completion by saying that it precludes the express warranty claim, but it doesn't, it's not a factor with the implied warranty claim because it moved on and found that it does apply in this case. So I think the implication is, you know, that this conversation or Judge Wall's decision was based on several different approaches. He found that there was no breach of contract because it wasn't substantially complete. The same was true for express warranty. But implied warranty does apply, even though, I mean, the implication is he's saying that, or the court was ruling that, you know, the claim could proceed even though there was not substantial completion.
Okay. I mean, that doesn't quite address my concern, and that is that he was never specifically asked to make, you know, a statement of law with respect to that.
I want to say, and it could be wrong, and I don't have it with me, but I believe there was a motion for judgment as a matter of law that was brought, and then there was a second one brought, and I think it was brought in that first motion, this issue of substantial completion. That's my recollection, but I don't want to mislead the court either. So, but what I can say is that this decision will have a profound effect on the construction industry, and it's a significant issue for contractors. How are they going to know when they can be sued for a breach of implied warranty for fitness of a particular purpose? What's the standard? What's the rule? How does that get applied? You know,
this has really been the state of things since 1966, at any rate, since Robertson was decided. I mean, it seems like the industry has dealt with this in some way.
I believe the industry has dealt with it, and that no one has brought, there have been no cases that have been brought to the appellate courts on this issue because no one ever thought that you could have, I mean, this is one way to view it, is no one considered that you can have a breach of implied warranty claim until the project is completed, because all of the language you find in Robertson and other decisions, it talks about the erected building, a building to be erected. It's all in the context of a completed project. There's no indication in any of the cases at any time that it applies to construction that has not reached that stage. And I think it's significant that there's a lack of cases or decisions out there. Because when one looks at those cases, they only apply to completed structures. And the right to cure, I believe, attaches at the end of once the project is completed, because, again, construction is a fluid process. And you can't always isolate certain components of the construction because the project is too integrated, the systems are too integrated. You know, your heating and your air conditioning system and the way your windows seal, they work together and they can create.
The homeowner can never just say, you are so incompetent, I don't want you on my property anymore. And then you pay for the work that was done, that's the $12,000. And then the jury, you know, here awarded $28,000 saying it's going to cost that much for them to fix what bad work's already been done. I mean, is that your, is you wait till everything's done, till drywall screws are used on all the siding for the whole house, and then there's a right to cure? And that, where does that come from, I guess would be my question.
It comes from the understanding that, again, and I apologize for revisiting this, but contractors should have the ability to remedy their work during the project. And again, as I mentioned earlier, you have there are oftentimes situations where something is not done correctly, but then because it's still within the construction phase, it gets addressed and it's not problematic. And I think that there's a real issue here as to the practicality of how this rule gets applied. What's the accrual date? Is it, and that's the real question. When is there a hard deadline when a claim accrues? And Minnesota, and I see that I'm out of time, if I could just have a brief moment to conclude. Mm-hmm. Minnesota law elsewhere recognizes that accrual of claims should wait until substantial completion or completion, and that's found in the statutory warranties under 327A, the statutory building warranties, and the 541051, the two-year statute of limitations. They both address situations and say that the accrual date has to wait until substantial completion or completion, and that should be the approach that this court should consider when reaching its decision.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Seeing no other questions, the court will take this matter under advisement and issue a decision in the required statutory time frame. Thank you both for your argument today and for your briefing. It's been very helpful to the court. We will hear our next case at 10:55 on zoom.gov, and at this time, the court will stand in brief recess. Thank you.